It's time to talk about the 1980s, and we're doing it with Danny Ainge. It's the Monday Locked On Celtics podcast. Millie's, let's go. Rain and Jay's back with the vengeance. Back. All the real Celtics fans in attendance. This the truth like 34. This like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. Crowd goes crazy, most in-depth coverage on the daily, mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings, focus like Danny at the deadline. Global with it, got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line. Play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day. Trying to stay in tune with the C's, it's the best way. Melly. John Corrales here of MassLive.com, and I want to thank you once again for making this podcast part of your daily routine still, even in this crazy time. I really appreciate you doing that. Special podcast today. We're going to do it in two parts, actually. Today and tomorrow, I talked to Danny Ainge for an hour about the 1980s, and it was great. He was very gracious. I thought it was going to be a much shorter podcast, but he really just expounded a lot and had a lot to say about the 1980s. So Danny Ainge, will start with him being drafted, the fight for him with the Toronto Blue Jays. We get into kind of, I don't know if you realize this, some of you older listeners might, younger listeners might not. Danny Ainge was a pretty elite athlete coming out of high school. All-American in high school football, basketball, and baseball. He played professional baseball for the Toronto Blue Jays, and that went to court. Then we talk about him and Bill Fitch, and the Celtics head coach in the early 80s. You might remember Mike Dinan and I talking about Bill Fitch coming in to replace the kind of crazy coaching carousel that came after Tommy Heinsohn with Satch Sanders and Dave Cowens and all of that. So Fitch and Ainge had a very poor relationship to start, but that changed, and that story is great. We talk about Larry Bird in this one, and we get all the way up to Kurt Rambis being clotheslined by Kevin McHale, all in this podcast. So let's get to that right now with Danny Ainge.
Let's dig just a little bit deeper before you come to Boston to play, because you are drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays, which right. Is a story that you've told before, but for the listeners here on the podcast, to hear it firsthand, that battle, because this goes to the courts. Before you join the Boston Celtics, Red Auerbach has to go to court to take you away from the Toronto Blue Jays. How did that go?
Well, so I guess I need a little background information. In 1977, I was drafted out of high school by the Toronto Blue Jays. I really had no interest. In 1977, I had been offered to be the number one pick in the Major League draft by the San Diego Padres. And we actually negotiated what that would be. And we never came to an agreement. And the rest of baseball knew that I had turned down the opportunity to be the number one pick in the draft and that I was going to go to college and play basketball and baseball. So I was drafted in the 15th round by the Blue Jays. And I just ignored them the entire summer after the draft and just went on my way. I was going to college. I had chosen to Brigham Young University. I was going to go play baseball and basketball there. And the Blue Jays kept watching me and kept persisting that I come and play in their minor leagues. And I just ignored that whole process. And until finally they came to me and offered me a contract and, felt like it was worth our while, and it would not prevent me from playing college basketball or attending college. So I went that route. Now, fast forward. So I signed this baseball contract out of high school. And then 4 years later, after 4 years of playing pro baseball in the summertime and college basketball in the wintertime, I was College Player of the Year in 1981, and the Celtics drafted me. Now, in that draft process, I was contacted by most every NBA team, and I told everybody the same exact thing, that I had 1 year left on my baseball contract that I planned to honor, and if they were to draft me and I didn't sign, I would go back into the draft the following year. And so there was a big risk in drafting me, especially what I had told everybody, which I genuinely meant. And I told Red Auerbach the same exact thing. Red calls me on the day of the draft in 1981, and he says, yeah, I don't want to hear all that stuff again. He goes, you're a basketball player, and, you know, we're going to draft you in the first round. And I said, great, go ahead. And so he did actually draft me in early in the second round. He drafted me, I think, with the 31st pick in the draft. And I remember I was playing against the White Sox in Chicago that day of the draft, and I snuck over to this hotel where they were televising the draft, and I was just in the back. Nobody even knew I was there. And but when I didn't get drafted by the Celtics, I think second first round pick, I just left and went to the ballpark and got ready for my game at Kaminsky. And so there was, I guess that's it. And then, you know, once I was drafted by the Celtics, it led eventually to my desire to, you know, give basketball an opportunity. And I talked with the Blue Jays about it. And this story could go on and on and on, but
keep going.
My wife is giving birth to our second child, Austin, my oldest son.
Uh-huh.
In Salt Lake City, and they're actually doing a deposition, and she's in the of her, and she's in the hospital, and I'm in the courtroom in New York City, and I'm listening to Red Auerbach and Peter Bavese. Now, this is a very interesting story, but Peter Bavese is the son of Buzzy Bavese. And Buzzy Bavese was with the Brooklyn Dodgers and was in charge of the Brooklyn Dodgers when Red actually had taken Bill Sharman away from the Brooklyn Dodgers.
So you're the second player he's taken away from that family.
Yeah. And, you know, I learned a big lesson there. You know, as Red stood on the witness stand with his hand on the Bible, and Peter put his hand on the Bible, and they took an oath and to tell the truth, as a 21 or 22 year old, I sat in this courtroom and just went, oh my gosh, like there's like the truth means nothing. This is all just a game.
Wow.
And it's about money. And, I don't know. I was a little deflated at that time of an awakening of what the world was really like.
That seems like a big shock then, that you, these guys are fighting over you and basically saying whatever that it took to get you. And go ahead.
It was 100% about money. And, you know, I mean, I think that Red really wanted me, and that was, you know, he was doing all he could to get my rights immediately. And the Blue Jays ended up winning the trial and winning the court case. And then it was just a matter of how much did the Celtics have to buy out my contract if I wanted to play basketball.
Wasn't that like a low number? Am I remembering that wrong?
No, it wasn't that low of a number in those days. I mean, it was more money than Larry Bird was making.
Ah.
It was more money than Kevin McHale was making. It was more money than my contract was.
Wow.
But it was significant in those days, yeah.
So, and just so people know, like, you played for the Blue Jays. You were an All-American football player in high school too, right?
Yes.
So, Danny Ainge in his 20s is an elite athlete out there, amongst one of the best baseball, football, and basketball players in the country. I just want to put that out on the record so maybe some of our younger listeners understand exactly the type of athlete we're talking about with Danny Ainge. We know we've got to stay home. You can't go out and go to a restaurant. You shouldn't be going from store to store to store. You got to go get your essentials and come home and be safe. So that means you need things delivered. And that's where Postmates comes in. You can get basically anything you want. If you're like me, you start thinking about what to eat. Once one meal is over, you're already planning for the next one. So that's why I love using Postmates. They deliver food from any restaurant that I can think of, and it comes right to my door. It's not just burgers. It's not just sushi. It's not just pizza, whatever it is. They like make life easier with grocery deliveries and convenience store deliveries and clothing store deliveries. You name it. No more trips. You can stay safe. Let them go out and do that work for you. No late night food runs. You don't even have to worry about where to grab lunch anymore. Just download Postmates on iOS or Android, find your favorites, and get anything you want delivered within the hour. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the app and use the code LOCKEDONNBA. That's code LOCKEDONNBA for $100 of free delivery credit with no minimum purchase for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
So you come to the Boston Celtics, your first year, your rookie year is the year after they won the title. So you're on the team with Larry, defending champions, Bill Fitch is the coach. What's it like playing for Bill Fitch?
Well, so, I came in even more difficult since circumstance than that is because the court case drew on and on. I was back at Brigham Young University, and I was coaching the JV team back then in 1981, and it didn't get resolved and then I didn't negotiate a contract until sometime in early to mid December. So, you know, we were already a month and a half, 2 months into the next season, which was my rookie year. And so I came in with a lot of hype. There was all this, you know, college player of the year, big payout to the Blue Jays, big contract, and a lot of expectations. Mm-hmm. And it was a rough year. I really believe that Bill Fitch, was going to put me in my place and tear me down and build me up in his image. And it was rough. It was a really, really painful and frustrating rookie season. Would be an understatement. But like you said, the team was good, was really good, and they didn't really need me. It was a luxury for them to have me. And so they were, Bill Fitch was not going to, he was going to make me earn it.
Yeah, the stories that I've read are that, Bill really tore into you and said something like your batting average was better than your field goal percentage or something along those lines.
I don't really care about that kind of stuff or remember much of those things that were said. It was more of a treatment.
Yeah.
A story about Coach Fitch was, and with me and Coach Fitch anyway. So when I was in my, so the next year, after my rookie year, which was a rough year, and we lost to the Sixers in the, after having a 3-1 lead in the playoffs. Then the next year, first day of training camp, I'm his starting two guard. And I started that most of that year, but the continued treatment, I didn't really like or appreciate. Mm-hmm. And it came to a head after the All-Star break. We were on the West Coast, and you know, we had a team meeting, and I'll never forget this. It's kind of a funny story, but Cedric Maxwell, the coach, was saying, like, why are, you know, Cedric, why are you not cheering for your teammates like you used to? You used to be, like, so bought into the whole team and everything else. And Cedric says, well, it's pretty tough for me to get my pom-poms after you call me the dumbest blankety blank you've ever seen as I come out of the game. And I remember laughing so hard at that. And like, Cedric was so funny, and he was such a loose player, and he was a great teammate. And I remember that scenario. And then later that night, we're playing against the Sonics, and Fitch does his typical treatment of me. Like, he calls timeout. Sonics are on a roll. Now, the Sonics have Gus Williams and Dennis Johnson and David Thompson, Jack Sigma. You know, they're a very good basketball team. And they won the championship just not too, you know, in 78, I think. And so this was a very, very good team. Anyway, they're on a little bit of a roll. Fitch calls timeout in a fury. And it says, you know, like, quit shooting threes. And, you know, and it was, and so the next, we come out of the timeout, the very next possession, Larry shoots a three. They get the rebound. He misses it. They get the rebound. They're fast breaking. You know, they score. And then the next time down the court, Tiny shoots a three. And they come down. They get the rebound, come down, fast break, and score. And, like, I'm back on defense, one on three, as these guys are coming at me. And, you know, he calls timeout again. And this time he comes out to me, and he points at me, and he says, Ainge, get your blankety-blank to the end of the bench. I don't want to see you anymore, like that. And, you know, ML, get him out. And I cursed at Fitch at that time. And, I had never cursed at a coach before. And I just lost my mind and just snapped on him. Anyway, after the timeout, he comes up to me and he says, hey, if you ever do that again, I'll have you so far out of this league, you won't know what hit you. And then he walked back to the bench, and, you know, I sat at the end of the bench the rest of the game. After the game, we get in the locker room, and Fitch says, comes and addresses the team, and he says, Danny, do you have anything to say to the team? And I said, yeah. I should have waited to call you such and such after the game so I could have finished the game. But, you know, until you have the balls to call Larry and Tiny and quit yelling at me and say something to them about what you want, then, you know, I have no respect for you. Wow. And I just left it that and went in the shower. Anyway, the team was like, they loved that I had stood up for myself in front of Fitch, and, you know, they knew all the stuff that was going on. And by the end of that season, I remember Cedric and Robert in the locker room in Milwaukee, where we ended up getting swept in the playoffs that year. And I remember those guys saying, like, if we win this series, Bill Fitch will be back coaching us next year. And I remember Kevin coming out and saying, if Coach Fitch is back, you know, I'm not going to sign as a free agent this off season. And so he had lost. And what's interesting is after I had my run-in with him, I all of a sudden, he started treating me completely different and treating me with the same respect that he treated those other guys. And now I liked him. And so, I mean, now it was like, okay, like, we have a mutual respect. You know, he used to take me out of the game, but when he took me out of the game, it was, you know, not calling me names, or it was more, you know, with respect. And I sat by Fitch long time on the plane after that night in Seattle. But, you know, our team was a little dysfunctional. We ended up winning 59 games that year. We're still a very, very good team. But I tell you that story just because we lost our spirit. You know, you need that extra to be great. You know, the extra of the 2008 team or the 1986 team was extra special from a chemistry and all one atmosphere. But anyway, that's sort of the I feel like I'm blabbing too much here.
No,
about
that's
the
fine.
Story.
I've got time.
That's what that year, and that was Bill Fitch. And by the way, I still feel that Bill Fitch, you know, winning the championship in 1981, and he was a really good coach. He prepared us all, and I still feel like he was part of our 1984 championship run, just because he, you know, was such an influential coach in a lot of ways and teaching us the game and, you know, leading into when KC took the team over.
Do you think then that Bill Fitch pulled something out of you that maybe needed to be pulled out of you, regardless of maybe his methods?
I don't. I don't feel that way. I feel like he held me back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, understandably so. Like I say, you know, when you're a young hot shot and you have all these dreams and expectations and you come in and you just don't even get opportunities to play, he puts you in for 3 minutes and pulls you out. I mean, I remember Cedric Maxwell working with me on my shooting that year one day, cause I was struggling with my outside shot, which I had never struggled in my whole life shooting the basketball. And, you know, after we spent an hour shooting, and he generously gave his time. We were working together on it. And my first shot that night, like, I hit the side of the backboard from the baseline. And we sort of laughed about that, and we still laugh about that. But, you know, like, you're just in not a good place mentally. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I think that I allowed things like my own expectations, the expectations of the world around me, the media, you know, to prevent me from playing as well as I could have played under those very difficult circumstances.
Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram. Let's kind of get a lay of the land here, because you're talking about the 1984 finals and Casey Jones is the coach. You've got Larry, you've got Kevin, you got Max. We've seen some of the videos. It feels like it's a loose team, but you've got a lot of big egos. You've got a lot of Hall of Fame players all around you. What's it like being on that team?
Well, you have some very, very strong personalities, and not only those in the Hall of Fame big three, but you also have, you know, Cedric, and you have ML Carr and Quinn Buckner, some very proven good basketball players and tough personalities. Strong personalities in that locker room. Then you have Gerald Henderson, who's a good player. And, you know, interesting story about Gerald Henderson. There was a article written recently about some of the great trades in Celtics history. And I personally think one of the great trades in Celtics history was done by Jan Volk when he traded Gerald Henderson for Len Bias. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately, that just didn't work out for us, but that turned out to be a good trade, you know, at that time. And in those moments, it was like the steal of the century. And Gerald was a very good player. And in 1982-83, Gerald was coming off the bench playing about 18 minutes a game. And I was starting and had a very good year. In the summer of 1983, I was carrying my son Austin around Disney World in Orlando. And I damaged my thoracic nerve in my neck, and it caused me to have what's called winging of the scapula, which they told me, like, there's no surgery to do to fix it. It's like, it's going to take 8 to 10 months just to get better on its own. And you can do this, and this to get it back. So I played with that the entire season. and I was not myself. And so Gerald had taken my job. I was playing with one arm, especially most of the first two-thirds of the season, and continued to play throughout the year, but it was very troublesome. And then the summer of 1984, the summer league was in San Diego. Now, in those days, we didn't have summer league like we do now. We had summer league. I mean, a little bit. They do it. They used to join teams. Like two teams would go play summer league together with one coach and so forth. But I played on a free agent team. I really didn't want that much association with the Celtics. I wanted to get away. And anyway, it was in San Diego, which is where I spent a lot of my off seasons anyway. And so it was really easy for me to play. And I went and played very well in that 1984 summer league. And KC Jones was out there watching me play, and KC and I were very close. And KC told me that, you know, keep playing like this, you know, you're going to get your starting job back. And it looks like you're getting, you know, your health is returned and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was excited about just that hope. And then when they traded Gerald, that opened up, you know, that made it easier for everybody for me to get the starting job back in 1984-85 season. But that was a roundabout way. But see, where were we? We're talking about Burdick. We're talking about the stars of our team. You know, Robert and DJ and Max and Kevin were all very good players, even special players. And you know, Larry was at a different level, and in my opinion, it was Larry. He just, his approach, his dedication to his craft, and his extreme confidence. Like, everybody on our team was very confident, but Larry was at a different level than most everybody else.
I mean, that's something that makes the greats great. I mean, what makes Larry Bird so much better than everybody else? I mean, he's not a tremendous athlete. I mean, there are tons of better athletes in the NBA than Larry Bird at that time. But what makes a guy like that so far better? Like, one of the best to ever play the game. I mean, that's a mental thing, right? I mean, how do you get to that? Is that something people are born with? Is that something? Can you train somebody to have that level of mentality and develop that level of confidence?
I don't think so. I don't think you can. I think that it is innate, to some extent. That doesn't take away from their incredible work, because, you know, Larry was, we all know how hard he worked to become great. But I think that his, you know, and I would argue that he wasn't a great athlete. I know he wasn't a great track athlete, but what his bit at 6'10", his shooting touch with both hands, his vision, his anticipation, you know, he was ambidextrous and incredible vision, beautiful touch with both hands. You know, that's like saying Kareem's not a good athlete. You know, at 7'4",
right,
there's never been another person that can shoot the ball like Kareem, and with the efficiency of Kareem with a sky hook. There's been, and you know, Kareem himself has tried to train many number one picks in the draft that same shot, but no one's been able to do it. And that's how Larry is that he was so unique with his gifts mentally and physically, but his competitive nature and his drive and his visual skills were, you know, I think that there's that, you know, like you get better at those with the hard work, but I think that some of that is just, you just have it in you.
Yeah, I guess. We have a tendency to say things like that, like not a great athlete, I guess, in comparison to the other players of his time. You don't make it to pro sports without being a great athlete. That I think that little caveat should be noted. But in comparison to others. But regardless, the thing with Larry Bird that always stuck with me is, you know, when he says, you know, I would picture Magic shooting 500 shots, so I had to shoot 600 or whatever it was. It's that mentality where somebody says, okay, I've shot 500 shots. That's enough. I've, you know, pat yourself on the back and you go and you get your treatment and you go home. Whereas somebody else, like a Larry or Michael Jordan or those level guys, there's something in them that just keeps telling them, no, you can't stop because somebody else is doing more. That thing inside somebody's head is always something that's fascinated me.
One of the great skills that Larry had that used to drive me crazy. I used to play Larry in the half court, the old Hellenic College gym. We had like half court basket, and we used to play like full court sideways at the basket before practice started. And we would play one-on-one full court in this. And, but you know, because I was quicker than Larry, I would always get up into him and make him and pressure him. But I don't even know how many times that, like, I defending him perfectly and like I clapped his hand with my hand as I tried to contest his shot and turn around and see the ball go in the basket. I mean, it was unbelievable, his ability to make shots under duress and under extreme pressure. I mean, he obviously did that with much better defenders than myself, guys like Dennis Rodman and Paul Pressey and Michael Cooper and everybody else as well. So, but it was just that was a skill that, you know, it wasn't blowing by people or anything like that, but his ability to make shots under that kind of duress was absolutely incredible.
So the 1984 Celtics win the championship. That's the series where McHale clotheslines Rambis. And that comes after Larry Bird just ethers the team in the locker room, right? Like how does that happen? Like when you hear your star player call you out, are you hearing it in the locker room? Are you reading it in the paper? And then what happens afterwards that gets the guys to go, okay, well, we got to step this up. How does that all happen?
Well, you know, so first of all, we're watching the game. Game three was, first of all, I mean, Gerald Henderson's steal in game two might have won. That might have been one of the biggest plays, you know, right there with Larry Bird's steal of Isaiah in Detroit. But that steal by Gerald Henderson might have been one, you know, that was better than the Havlicek stole the ball play. Because if we don't get that steal and win that game two in Boston, we probably don't win the series.
Right.
And that was one of the huge plays in Celtics history that I think is, you know, goes underrated. But that was a great play by Henderson. But in game three, so we get blown out in game one. We are so lucky to win game two. We probably are in the one percentile of winning that game. And then in game three, we get crushed again. And it's just a dunk fest. And so what I remember is I remember Larry saying some things in the media, you know, about how soft our team is or whatever terms he used. But, you know, Larry, he wasn't like a real screamer and yeller, but every single person that was watching that film was completely embarrassed and humiliated by our effort in game three in Los Angeles. And I remember Kevin, as we're going out to stretch for practice the next day, Kevin saying, you know, like, we've got to take guys out. And I said, like, we got to make some hard fouls. And I said, Kevin, I get booed in every arena because I take hard fouls. Like I said, why don't you foul somebody hard one time? And you know, like, I think that but when the fact that it was Kevin who took Rambis down with clothesline, in my opinion, I think was even way more exciting than if Larry had done it. And the fact that Kevin had done that, that was exciting for his teammates. Like, that was inspirational play for us to see Kevin, like, go, wow, that's what we're talking about. Okay, so you talk the talk, now you did it. I love that. That was one of my favorite Kevin plays ever.
If you could sense Danny Ainge's joy in the hard foul from Kevin McHale, I picked up on it too. That was my follow-up question, and that's coming up tomorrow to kick off tomorrow's podcast and getting into the 86 season and getting into Bill Walton and getting into the I Hate Danny Ainge shirt and then the jokes that he played on Johnny Most. Cigarette smoking on an airplane. That's all you need to know about that. It's the second part, another half hour of a great conversation with Danny Ainge. So please subscribe to get more of this. We're going to have a very extended discussion about the 80s. I'll get Mike Dinan back on. We'll get Chuck McKinney in. And we're going to really take a very deep look. This is going to be longer than the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Because now this is where I get involved. I'm starting to have my own memories of the Boston Celtics and some other local memories. We'll get into a lot of, there's a racial element to this and the Celtics-Lakers rivalry. There's a lot. So this era, this 80s decade is going to extend beyond this week. I haven't really fleshed out all of it, but it's going to go beyond this week. The 80s will continue into next week. So you've got to subscribe to make sure you get all of the shows. And if you could, you could share the podcast. You could tell everybody that you know that they should be listening to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network. Now tell your smart device to play the newest episode of Chad Ford's NBA Big Board.